Dan is a longtime statesman and lawyer by trade and has been active in Israeli politics since the early 80s. He has served as an MK of the Likud and Center Party in six Knessets and has held a variety of ministerial posts, ranging from Minister of Justice to Deputy Prime Minister. Additionally, Dan has served as the president of the Israel Council on Foreign Relations and has written for multiple publications. In the last election, Dan was an outspoken critic of Likud. So first, a few technical matters. All callers will be muted while Dan is speaking. When we open the call to questions, you will be able to address Dan by unmuting yourself. To unmute your call, you'll need to press *6 in order for us to hear you. Please remember to press *6 again once you've finished asking your question in order to remute your call. This will help us cut down on background noise. So right now I'm going to mute everyone, and then we can begin. Great. So Dan, ready when you are. Are you there, Dan?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So, yeah, feel free to begin.
Good evening here from Jerusalem. It may be somewhat earlier in the United States. I was asked to speak of Israeli democracy, and let me say the following. I think there was a change in the discourse about democracy in recent decades. If you utter the words democracy, human rights, rule of law in your political discourse, today you are depicted a leftist. These were the terms that Menachem Begin used to use every week. These are the values he protected and fought for. So what has been a common basis, an agreed basis for the discourse, for the political debate, has shifted in a negative way, in my view. So let me begin by saying something about the way democracy is perceived in a more general way, and then focus on the Israeli case. I think democracy is sometimes misunderstood to mean primarily the rule of majority. If I take the American attitude towards the Arab Spring, both Democrats and Republicans, there was a general perception, understanding, I thought it was wrong, that once the dictator is sent home and the majority votes, you have democracy. Hence the enthusiasm with the Arab Spring, words like Mubarak has to go now, we want to be on the right side of history, democracy comes because the people speak. All this meant that the people thought in America and in other places that once you have majority rule, you have democracy. And once Mubarak goes home, a new Thomas Jefferson is going to be born on the Nile and in no time build a new republic. Of course, the development was different because democracy, in my view, is not characterized mainly by the rule of majority. In fact, I know very few dictators with the majority voting for them. Democracy is primarily about human rights, if you like, about what democracy cannot do, about what majority cannot do in democracy. If the Knesset tomorrow morning votes in 100 against 20, that I cannot pray, I cannot lay tefillin, or I have to lay tefillin, I don't need to obey these rules because majority doesn't have the power to infringe on my basic human rights. So in fact, democracy is based on the attitude toward the individual, toward minorities, even more than on what, of course, is necessary, a rule of majority regarding who is the ruler, who is the prime minister, who is the president. Having said that, I want to go to the Israeli society and see what happens here. I think that in the Israeli society, for many years, the balance between the needs of the general public, of the state, of the people, of the nation, if you like, on one hand, and the individual rights or group rights or minority rights has been set not only by legislation, even more so by the Supreme Court, the legal system, that not having a written constitution has given us the basic human rights from the early 50s on. And along the years, we have created the system, a legal constitutional system of what we call basic laws, chapters of the Constitution. And the last one, I am still quite proud to have been the Justice Minister those days. We've enacted the basic human rights laws. And this balance is very important generally, but more important when you are in time of conflicts with others, with other nations, with other peoples. Because when there's a huge conflict, take America in the Second World War and the way it treated the Japanese, if you like, people don't care much about individual rights. People say, don't give us this talk now. We need to fight the war. We need to finish the business. Don't come with these human rights issues, standard of behavior, rules of engagement, all these things. And because we, unfortunately, for over 60, almost 67 years, always have to defend ourselves or fight, if we give up on this and say only rule of majority, no human rights, we are in very bad condition regarding democracy. What I've seen in recent years, about 20 years, is a growing trend that became popular and beneficial politically to attack the values and the institutions that stand for these values, mainly the Supreme Court and their role in our life. And as for many years, it was agreed from Menachem Begin on one side to, say, Meir Yari of Mapam on the other side, that the Supreme Court is held above politics. It became a target of attacks by people because they stand for those basic rights, human rights, liberal ideas that we believe in. So this is a development that worries me very much. My own party, the Likud, of which I was one of the early members, I would say, from day one, called itself, or Menachem Begin called it, Likud, a national liberal movement. Not only national, of course, nation is very important. We are about Jewish, building a Jewish state, Jewish peoplehood, and so forth, but also liberal, that is to say, the private, the person, the individual. I saw, unfortunately, in my own party, the balance shifting, and talks that, to me, were very tough regarding the importance of the Jewishness, but less regard to democracy. Jewishness being interpreted in a very special and extreme way, and putting the values of human rights and treatment of minorities as non-Jewish, to me was very dangerous, and I spoke against them. By the way, even Jewishly, I think that we are standing now by history for a test, a historic test. For many years, for many decades, and in fact centuries, Jews have been champions of human rights, even in America for the blacks, and in Europe and other places. But it's not, as we say in Hebrew, zelo chokhmah, it's not a big thing to stand for human rights when you are a minority. Of course Jews would be for that, because they are a minority. So the fact that American Jews are for human rights means very little to me, because they protect themselves. The real test comes when you are the majority. And after so many years in one place, Israel, we are the majority. Now our test is, how do we treat the minorities amongst us, whether it's Arabs against Jews or religious and seculars or others in all sorts of ways? Do we defend the minorities? Do we give the individual and the minority the same rights that we wanted, that we would have and never had in many centuries of Gola, of diaspora? So it is a political test, it is a moral test, it's a historic test, and I think that what has been well understood and agreed by everybody is now standing under attack and needs to be defended, the Israeli democracy. There are all sorts of ways to define democracy. My way is to keep the balance and not to give up on human rights, individual rights. After all, it's the individual that is the end of all those institutions. We build a state for people, not people for states. And that we keep individual rights and the institutions that protect them, especially the legal system and the Supreme Court above all, to defend the individual even against the arbitrariness of the majority. defend the basic values is a major fight that goes on in Israeli society. I have to say, in ending this opening remark, that even the role of religion in our politics is going through a change, and dangerously so. All over the world around us, you see in the Arab Spring the decline of the national identity and the growth of religious identity or tribal identity. All the structure that was built by the colonial powers 100 years ago after the First World War, building states and nations like Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and so forth, Iraq. People would say now, if you ask them, who are you, they won't say we are Iraqi. They would say we are Shiite, we are Sunni, and so forth. And the Zionist idea that Jews are a nation and you can be totally secular and fully Jewish was a huge revolution in Jewish life. As Herzl and Jabotinsky and Ben-Gurion and Weizmann were all full Jews, although they did not keep the mitzvot and they were not religious. This too is being put in the center of a new thinking, a new fight over the basic values of the country. And what it is to be a Jewish state, or what it is to be a Jew, is another issue that is being discussed sometimes intellectually and deeply, sometimes quite superficially and emotionally. So Israeli politics that we've seen in last election and before this had elements in it that if you look into them in a broad and deeper way, see those trends I speak of. And I think all of us who care about our Jewish values and our democratic values and the right balance of individual and state or a person and a society need to fight for those basic values of which we are quite proud that we have been able to build in the State of Israel. Let me pause here, and now it's all your turn to tell me where I was wrong and to ask me other questions.
So thank you so much. Again, just to repeat, if you have a question for Dan, you will need to press *6 to unmute your call. We ask that you please remember to remute your call after you've asked your question by pressing *6 again in order to help us cut down on the background noise. Also, please refrain from entering into a debate with Dan or asking follow-up questions so that everyone can have an opportunity to ask their question. And finally, please introduce yourself and where you're calling from before asking your question. So let's open this up.
I have a question. It's Nancy Bernstein from Pittsburgh.
Yes.
My question is, how do you begin to address this question of, you know, what is a Jewish state? In a meaningful way in the country.
Well, it's a very important question. There are all sorts of ways to define it. My definition is a minimal definition. And it's taken from a source that you might have heard of called Zeev Jabotinsky. When he gave a testimony about Zionism to the British Commission regarding Palestine in 1937, he said, and asked, what is a Jewish state? And he said, Jewish state is one thing, a state where the Jews are the majority. All the rest does not need to be in the Constitution. In other words, a minimal response. If you want to go further and make it more meaningful, you need to ask yourself what it is to be a Jew. Now, what is to be a Jew is an open question. I may have one definition, the chief rabbi another one, and you another one. And this is a good intellectual debate. One does not need to reach a conclusion that everybody agrees with. That is why to say Jewish state in a more, in a broader and deeper way will lead us into controversy. Into disagreement. The basic is that we need a Jewish state. This is a state where the Jewish people expresses and exerts its right of self-determination. It assumes, basically, that Jews are a nation. A good question, by the way, for Jews who don't live here. What nation do they belong to? But if the Jews are not a nation, just a religion, religions don't deserve states by President Wilson, the self-determination. Saying we are a nation, we Jews are a nation, and we can be fully Jewish even if we are not religious, like the leaders of Zionism, as I mentioned, and others, And you can have different interpretation of religion regarding the religious, Jewishness and religious elements. This is an open debate. But as far as the law is concerned and the constitution and the basic definition, in my view, should be a minimalistic, not a maximalistic definition of the word the Jewish state.
Thank you.
This is Sam Fleischacker. I'm calling from Chicago. I thought everything you said just now was wonderful, but I would wonder whether there is room for you still in the Likud. I mean, in some ways what you said sounded more or less like someone from Meretz. Have you thought about switching parties? Are there practical reasons not to do that? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I happen not to agree with Meretz on many things. I don't want to go into them now. Meretz had, for example, the illusion that if you only give up land, you make peace. This was a major issue in Meretz. I think that Olmert tried it and failed, and Barak tried it and failed, and Peres tried it and failed, and Rabin tried and failed. And I'm not sure Meretz has faced up to this failure. That I don't fit Likud, yes, I don't fit what Likud stands for today, which is why I'm not there. I didn't go for last election, although I might have been able to if I wanted to. Some people want me to do that. I need for myself this balance of the rule of majority and human rights. I need the balance of the interests of the nation, which are very important to me, and the interests of the individual. So I don't know what party stands for it. I don't want to speak in political party political terms. But I found in the Likud a good party. And the fact that Menachem Begin had to fight for democracy when the government was Labor, when the left wing was in government, and they did not really give basic rights, not to Arabs where they held them under the military government, or in many other aspects, means that there's no monopoly on human rights. I agree that the way that my old party Likud acts now makes it very difficult for somebody like me to find myself in their campaign, and I wasn't there. But between this and Meretz, there still is a gap.
Thank you.
Next question. Okay. Dan, I have a question for you. This is Adam from Partners for Progressive Israel. So I think it's very unique to actually be speaking to a former Minister of Justice when there is now such controversy over Ayelet Shaked's appointment to the Minister of Justice position. So I'm curious, as a former Minister of Justice, do you see her appointment as a genuine threat to Israel's democratic character?
I know Ayelet Shaked superficially. I don't know her very well. She's a newcomer to the political world, and I was out of it for the last 2 years, so I don't want to be too specific. But the ideas that she expressed in public are not what I would have wanted to hear from a Minister of Justice, because they do express a view or philosophy of the legal system and the rule of the courts in Israel that is something that befits, by the way, parties that are more to the left in the past, like Kadima in their time, when the Prime Minister Olmert appointed Professor Friedman to be Minister of Justice, who used to say that the Supreme Court, once said, the Supreme Court acts like a chapter of Meretz, and created an awful damage to the Supreme Court in the public eye. If Ayelet is going to repeat that attitude, it's going to be detrimental. But I want to give her the benefit of the doubt or of my ignorance. Let's see how she acts. There are several tests ahead. Are we going to see a strengthening of the independence of the judiciary? Are we going to see appointments of people who are known to be more conservative? I mean, do we go the American way? That is, in political appointment of judges, the Supreme Court, or do we go the Israeli way, where the appointment was not made by only by political people, but by a committee where the political people are minority. I think our system is much better than the American system in that sense. Judges are not recognized by the political political ideology. Do we see a discourse that respects the rule of law, the execution of judgments given by the Supreme Court regarding settlements in the past? There was this question, you remember, or other issues. Or do we see a discourse that says the court should not intervene, it's not for them? We were elected, we are the elected leaders, we should not give the court this power. So I don't want to prejudge how Ayelet Shaked will act. Some things that she has said in the past, some bills that she has promoted in previous Knesset, are not what I would have done. I did stand against them. But let's see how she acts. And it is, to me, of great importance. It's usually and not seen as one of the two or three major ministries like defense, foreign affairs, finance. To me, it's of a great importance because, as I said, it stands for the values, not necessarily of the majority that changes from time to time, for the basic democratic values and for the institutions that protect and preserve them. So I hope that the Minister of Justice will not be a minister that will attack the system and weaken it, like I'm afraid Professor Friedman did. In my opinion, he did it very clearly. Everybody saw that. I hope she will act in a way that will preserve and protect the system from political interference.
I hope so too. Thank you. I just want to make sure that everyone on the line has muted themselves. There seems to be a little echo, and I think we can get rid of that if everyone makes sure that they press star 6 and mute themselves unless they have a question.
I do have a question. It's Lily Rivlin, and I know of you for many years. I'm Ruvi's cousin, and in marriage. And I want to ask you because two-part question: the Jewish state, as you defined it, I just heard the end of it is that it's a Jewish state because it's a majority. So how will you, part one, how do you make sure that the Jews remain a majority? Because that's always a troubling thing for me in trying to work out the Jabotinsky position. And part two is, it's a pity that you are not in the political realm right now because your opinion is very important. Can you do something in the political realm to educate the Likud followers so we don't have the kind of anti-Arab position that seems to dominate today in Israel?
Well, let me say first personally, I'm sitting now in my room in the home I was born in a good number of years ago, and opposite me I see the house where Ruvi Rivlin was born,
yes,
and the president of Israel, because we were neighbors since I was born. He then was 8 years older than me. I think this gap remained to this very day. But we are very good friends for many, many years, and I think he so far has acted marvelously as the president of Israel, and he made statements and voiced the positions that should have been voiced and made by the leadership, and the political leadership did not make enough of them. He did it regarding all those issues, and I think he's a very good, fine man. Now back to your question about the Jewish majority and how we protect it. I said earlier, I don't want to go deeper into that. We are in a phone call after all, and it's not the time for that. But I said I want to define for the state, for the law, the term Jewish state in a minimal way. I don't want to go into deeper interpretation. But of course, once there is a Jewish majority, which is a condition sine qua non, we need it. Of course. The other question is how much and what of Jewish values do we take to try to make the values of the state, of the society. In Jewish studies, in Jewish scriptures, you have almost everything. You have the most liberal approach, and you have other approaches. And I think one need to choose. And I choose those that fit my democratic values. And I don't choose those that were chosen by this American immigrant to Israel, Zionist, he thought himself, Rabbi Meir Kahana. I don't take these, but he took it too from some Jewish scriptures. So I think it's up to us in the end to choose those values that I think are the real representation of what I want to see in the state of Israel. Now going back to how we preserve a Jewish majority, let me say simply, if we don't have a Jewish majority, Zionism is lost. Zionism is based on having a Jewish majority. By the way, Zionist movement, long many decades before there was a state, demanded a Jewish majority. Why? Only for one reason. Because everybody votes. If you said Arabs don't vote, who needs a majority? In other words, Zionism is a democratic concept by the principle. Otherwise, you don't need majority. You can do the South African way of old South Africa. So, of course, we need a majority. And if it's a vast majority, a very substantial majority, 80%, 75%, then it is really the expression of our self-determination with all rights given to the minorities individually and group rights and all the rest. This is one thing. If you don't have it, if you have 50% or 52% or 48%, you have a binational state. This was, by the way, the idea of the left, of Mapam, many, many years ago. I think it was wrong even then. Can it work? I think not. But let me tell you further. What we have with the territories now puts us before or on the horns of a dilemma. If I look backwards to the 67 war, I'm ancient enough to have fought in that war as a tank commander. I remember it vividly very well. After the war, when the territories of Judea, Samaria, and Gaza came to our hands, in a justified war, in a justified fight for our life, for our survival, I think both sides of the political map knew one thing. What has happened now cannot be the permanent status. It's temporary. This is not something that can be perpetuated. Some said, in the end, we're going to an exit and give everybody rights, like Begin wanted to do. Some people in the left wing said, we're going to give it up and then end up with the 67 plus minus lines. One thing is clear. What we had is an anomaly, justified, but needs to be resolved. 48 years later, I'm afraid some people say we can't give up the land because of our security or because of attachment biblically, historically, religiously. On the other hand, we can't give up rights because then we lose a majority. This is not possible. You need to choose, and the choice is tough. But you need to make a choice. You can't refrain from it saying, no, it's not important, we'll see. Because in the long run, the goal needs to be clear, even if it can't be achieved now. And the goal needs to be, I think, a Jewish state with vast majority, which is why, painfully and very, very difficult it is to me, I have to give up part of my historic homeland in order to preserve a Jewish state in the democratic way. I respect people who say, no, we want to have the entire land. We're not going to give up an inch. We have liberated the state, the land. But you can liberate the land only if you liberate all the people on it. You can't liberate the land and occupy the people. So I respect those people, and the results will be 50-50, 60-40, something very different from now. I don't respect, I don't accept the legitimacy of those who say, we won't give them rights, but we'll keep the land. This is something that I think is untenable. In a way, this is what makes us look in a negative way in the eyes of many people who would otherwise support us.
Thank you.
Now, the other question, whether I'm going back to politics or not, I think that the way things stand now, I did not go to the political competition recently held in Israel in the election, because my party was not the party that stands for what I believe in, and they and I could not find a way together. The future is still open, and we'll see.
Thank you. Tada.
Thank you. I just need to reiterate that everyone press *6 to mute themselves when they're finished asking the question, just so we can cut down on the echo and the background noise. Are there any more questions?
Ben?
Yes.
Hi, this is Maya Haber from Pittsburgh.
Yes, Maya.
I think my question regards our audience, which is mostly American Jews who deeply care about Israel and about its democracy. And my question is there anything we can do about this? Like, if you were an American Jew, how would you pressure Israel to do what you believe is right, which is also what we believe is right?
Well, you see, I think that I have to say that I think what is well understood, if you compare Israel to all its neighbors, we are 10 times more, 100 times more democratic than all our neighbors. To compare Israel to other countries in times of war, I mentioned the Japanese detained in America. I can think of German passport holders, even Jews. In Britain, in the Second World War, we don't do that badly. But I don't compare myself to bad examples of the past. I want to stand up to the values that I think are right. So it's not that we are not a democracy now. We stand a risk of losing major elements of it, as I said earlier, if we don't find a way to correct what I mentioned. I think it has to do with education and with the finishing, hopefully, the constitution work in a good way and maintaining the basic values. But going to your question about the Jews in diaspora, America specifically, and the way to influence Israeli political standing or political positions. You know, you ask me what I would have done had I been an American Jew. I don't know. My values would tell me go to Israel. And this is the simplest way. Because, you know, because I'm a Democrat, the decisions in Israel are going to be made by the Israelis, Jews and Arabs. All that hold Israeli passports and can vote here. Those who chose not to be here have less of a way, a possibility to influence. I want to take this metaphor. You know, take a company that has shareholders. I think we Israelis, all of us, are shareholders. Jews in diaspora are option holders. They have an option to become an Israeli, so they have an interest in that company. They want it to prosper, they want it to do well, so they have an influence, they can exert their influence, and I'll come in a minute to how, but it's a influence of an option holder who didn't choose to realize its option and make it a share. So this needs to be remembered, even as a Democrat who says that people who are in Israel, Israelis, need to decide Israeli fate because it's they who will pay the first price. But it's true that if there is damage done to Israel or some other negative development in our standing in the world, it does affect American or diaspora Jews as well. Well, I think we need to be open to conversation, discourse, debates, and talk to each other. I don't think that people abroad, especially Jews abroad, who have a right to be citizens here and who belong to the Jewish nation, have no right to say what they think. I think they have a right to say whether it's left or right, whether it's dovish or hawkish, they have a right to say. And if they want to bring about a change, I think they should ask themselves, how is the change going to be brought about? If it's a political change, it needs to be brought about by the Parliament of Israel, the Knesset. And you need to speak to the Israelis. They will vote. They will vote for the Knesset, and they will decide what the political makeup of Israeli political scenery will look like. There is a way to educate people, not just by election. And I know many people who contribute, who involve themselves and engage in educational processes in Israel regarding what is democracy, what are the values, what sort of Judaism we want to see. I remember debates about who is a Jew that you remember very well, where many American Jews were scared that Israel is going to send a very negative signal to the majority of Jews abroad. And I remember the talks even with my Prime Minister then, Prime Minister Shamir, and how influenced he was with the people coming from the Reform and Conservative movement, that he changed his course and said, I'm not going to go with the ultra-Orthodox, who will not change the law the way they wanted it. So there is a discourse. Israel has a responsibility, first and foremost, for its citizens, but second, not less importantly, to the Jewish world. It sees itself as the home of the Jews, potentially for all Jews, and it needs to act in a way that takes into account Jewish interests worldwide. So I think there is a way to talk, to influence, to debate, to come, to invest, to tour the country. In the world of today, the modern world, the technological world, it's much easier. It's much cheaper and easier to talk. The meeting of minds can be made between New York and Tel Aviv or Jerusalem and Washington or Los Angeles and Sderot on the internet, on the telephone. It's not the old days where it was very difficult. And I think the more people come here, the more they get involved, the more influence they're going to have.
Thank you so much, Dan. Are there any more questions?
Yes, Dan, this is Leonard Grob in New York.
Yes.
There's been talk by some in the new government that they will attempt to hinder the activity of the human rights amutot, the NGOs in Israel,
yep.
by taxing money coming from foreign nations and such. Can you address that situation? Is there anything wrong with NGOs accepting money from foreign governments?
Well, there were proposals like this put on the table in the Knesset and in the public sphere in the last government, not this one, the government before, when I was still deputy prime minister and member of the cabinet. And I and Rubi Rivlin, that you mentioned, and Benny Begin and Miki Etan within the Likud fought very tough against it. And I think we might have had some influence on the prime minister not to go this way. I think it's wrong. I think what you would call First Amendment, or the freedom of expression, of speech, of expressing yourself, needs to be guarded against those trends. Is there a problem with foreigners contributing? Nobody says this because everybody or many parties do take support from abroad. It can be of somebody who is very rich in America. It can be from a government in Europe. It can be some NGO in the world. So to make it one-sided and say only if it's in a certain direction, it's illegitimate, or only if it's given by the European Union, it's illegitimate, I think is wrong. The question, there are other questions like, do you need to declare that you get support from abroad? Maybe yes, and I'm not against it. I think people should know if somebody supports. I think America has rules that are somewhat parallel to this. Should we promote taxation or other hindrances? No way. I think it's a big mistake. What are the ways to fight it? First of all, the political debate in the Knesset is one way, and the public debate. In certain cases, it may even be brought to the Supreme Court. Although our Constitution is not as well entrenched as the American Constitution, the Supreme Court, if they stand on these basic principles with the courage that characterized the Supreme Court in the past, I think some of these positions, some of these proposals do not stand the constitutional test, and they should not be allowed, even if there's a majority in Parliament for them. So this is a fight. I'll tell you, some years ago in the Hebrew University, they asked me to give a speech in the ceremony of, I think, people who graduate from the Faculty of Law. There was a big audience in the crowd, and I said to them things that they didn't understand. And I said, you're leaving this faculty now, and you go to your own business. Now, listen carefully. You need to fight. And they didn't know what I meant. I said, in the old days, you didn't need to fight for those basic values. It was accepted. You need to fight for territories, for peace, for, you know, economic reforms. But the basic principles and values were protected and preserved. Don't fight for them. We may lose them. And I think the same thing applies even today. The attempt to silence people, or say you are not allowed to get support from abroad, I think is wrong. There's another question whether an Israeli body should take strictly political support for political purposes from a foreign government that wants to influence Israeli politics. That's a good question. Sometimes one shouldn't do it. Sometimes it's legitimate, but one needs to be very specific in what one does. After all, it's Israelis who have to make a decision. But in the globalized world of today, you can't really disconnect yourself from the world. Somebody can influence me on the web without being in Israel. So it's not a territorial question anymore. And if people want to influence me and they put a good film in Hollywood that I see for the same values, or they put a good program on some social network, people can influence me. So the borders do not stop ideas and values from being transmitted across them.
Thank you, Dan.
You're welcome.
Are there any more questions?
Yes, I had one. I'm Warren Ingber from New York City. My question, Dan, is whether, in addition to the legal and constitutional norms that you were speaking about, well, in the United States, for instance, there's that way of looking at problems with our politics, but the other handle is usually the influence of money. And I don't hear enough talk about that in the Israeli press. The flap over Yisrael Hayom, the free newspaper that's given out, that's basically Netanyahu's propaganda sheet, as it's described here. I haven't read it myself, but you know that is one thing where you hear about money in politics. Of course, there's a common denominator in Sheldon Adelson. So you know that's really my only example of that. And what I was wondering is whether there's a view, your own view, but also the view of other people, including in Likud, about some undue influence of money in politics, and whether that's part of what has to be fixed. You know, with the 20 families, and this is all I hear, though. You know, I don't get enough of a feel for that. Whereas in the United States, it's a very big
well,
thing among the
connection between government and money, or how money influences government, is a problem for every democracy. Israel has it, America has it, others have it. I think it's very institutionalized in America, and the debates I hear about lobbying and about the money for PACs and so forth has been an issue that is dealt with in America. I think we have much stricter laws than America regarding what one can do and how much money one can give and what is considered money given. If it's not given directly but indirectly, people were brought to court because of this, people were sent to jail because of this. I think we have very strict laws, but the fact that people want to use their money to influence for the politics they believe in poses a real question of, if you like, First Amendment. If I believe in peace and I want to give all that I have for peace, can I give it to parties who believe in peace? If I live in the land of Israel in its entirety and I'm ready to give everything I have for this, am I allowed to do that? What is done officially, what is done under the table, these things are debated, and the question of politics and money, or the rich guys, the tycoons, or whatever the name would be, or the character would be, are things that are debated here, even recently, and debated in America, and in many other countries. I think we have a relatively open and transparent system where every contribution needs to be registered and open to the public, and the limit of how much you can collect altogether for a campaign in the party and between the parties, and how much you can collect from one person or one family. This does not mean that people who have power try to use their power. And there's an ongoing, continuing battle, so to speak, between people who want to influence and the parties that want to get the money, and on the other hand, to see less influence of money on decision-making. It's an ongoing issue, and you see it in all countries that are democratic, including ours.
Thank you.
Are there any more questions?
Yeah, this is Jim DeVore from Brooklyn, New York. I wish you could elaborate further on this doctrine of Jewish democracy, which we wanted to get vague intimations of. To the extent that it's a coherent ideology, can you describe it and comment on it?
Yes, I think, well, it's a broad issue and a deep issue, and it has philosophical, historical, cultural, political aspects to it. I don't pretend to do all of that now, but I would say the following. There are many ways to define Jewishness, what it is to be a Jew. And there are many different ways to define democracy. You have the American democracy, which is different from the British democracy, from the Israeli, from, you know, there were many kinds of democracy. When I want to take two sets of values, the democracy set of values and the Jewishness set of values, and I want to marry them, to merge them in a way, to merge them into one coherent system, I would say the following. We need to take a definition of Judaism that fits in with democracy, and the definition of democracy that fits in with Jewish values. In other words, only those values that fit both systems are the ones that will get into the new merger that I have spoken of. Now, this is not my invention. Aaron Barak, the former Chief Justice, developed it very well in some of his judgments and books. I think it's a good approach because, you know, it has to do with what we are speaking of recently, Jewish state, what it is a Jewish state. For some people, Jewishness means only religion, no other definition. If you look back into our history, in the 10th century, in Babylon, Rav Seadia Gaon, one of the Geonim, said the following: "We are nation are defined by the Torah. En umatenu uma ela betorateha." In other words, it's only religion that defines us. Might have been the case until 18th, 19th century, with Enlightenment, with the growth of nations in Europe, the spring of nations, and the Zionism. We change the definition. We say Judaism can be a religion and can be a culture, can be a peoplehood or nation, and it's a very emotional debate. It's very ideologically difficult debate. For some people, everybody who thinks that one can be fully Jewish and not lay tefillin is unheard of. For others to say that in order to be Jewish you need to lay tefillin is as unheard of. But it's a new debate in the last 100, 200 years. So I think it's an open debate that cannot be decided by law. The law needs to do the minimum needed, and we don't need much of it. I think the law is a law of a country, of a state. We are not a Jewish community. American may be a Jewish community, French have a Jewish community. We are a state, not a community, not another community. The state is the state of all the citizens, the majority of which or whom are Jewish. And we need to introduce our Jewish values in the most effective but still livable and democratic way. So, but I don't need to stress 10 times a day that I'm a Jewish state because there's a minority here. Why do we need to tell them day and night that it's not their state? As if there is a dichotomy between being a Jewish state and a state of all its citizens. I don't think there's a dichotomy. It is a state of all its citizens. It is Jewish because the Jews are a vast majority of it. I don't think we need to create those dichotomies, those contradictions, because they are not going to be solved by law. They can be discussed in intellectual and social and political debates, but the law should stay as remote from that as possible.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any final questions?
Yeah, hi, this is Dina Charnin, calling from New York City. Thank you so much for speaking with us. I was interested, since we've talked about some of the critiques about what's going on in Israeli society, I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about two things you happened to mention, which was the Constitution and education, which I gather are your two main areas where you see as improving the situation. I mean, a little frustration I have in listening to you is I sort of feel a lack of sense of urgency. I mean, maybe it's because you're a calm minister of justice type of tibbutz, but I feel that you recognize, and I very much respect and appreciate your recognition of these issues and of some of the democratic erosions in Israeli society, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the Constitution, about education, about the fact that these things are take a long time to implement, and also what your ideas are for getting the genie, the problematic genie back in the bottle, and what your sense of your responsibility is in Israeli society for maybe mentoring younger Israeli leaders with your point of view on democracy in Israel. Thank you.
Well, it's a broad question. I can't answer it in a simplistic way. I would say that it is urgent. In some areas, I think it's not a question of majority, it's a question of leadership. Many nations, many societies in times of crisis or in times of conflict would not give much attention to basic democratic values. Think of America and the attitudes of the blacks until the 60s, until Montgomery, Alabama, until what you remember from the Brown versus Board of Education. The American Constitution or the American Declaration of Independence says all men are created equal, but they never meant a word of it. Men were just men, not women, and just white and not black, until Lincoln, until recently other changes. So I think there is, it's a question of leaders. It's not only the wording, it's not only the law. And in spite of the fact that there may be a tendency for nationalistic and extreme and intolerant attitude, if the leaders say, this is not done, don't do it, I think people will listen. I don't think in the 50s or 60s there were less pressure in this society. But as I said earlier, the expressions that are bordering on racism sometimes, like what happened with the Arab child who was burnt here, which is an awful thing when things of it, and other elements that we've seen, the hatred to the other might have existed as it exists all over the world in all societies. But when the leaders say, don't do these things, it's not done, it's out of the question, they have an important role. And I said earlier that Rubi Rivlin, our president today, does exactly this. When the silence of the political leadership is shouting out loud, say, don't do this. These things are unheard of. It's a question of education, not by the system, not only by the system of schools and universities and whatnot, but by the leadership. Leadership can be political leadership or other leadership. People follow certain role models. People who lead the public opinion need to stand for those principles, and this is their obligation. I am one of those people who have been in the political arena for quite a long time. And I said my views. I've never hidden them. And people voted me before because of these views or in spite of these views. I don't know, but they voted me. And until came a time where because of what I said, the Likudniks didn't want me to represent them. I think rightly, because I can't represent the trend of today in this party, unfortunately. I hope it will be reversed. I don't know when and how. I think it's important for the country. It's important for Israel. And so the constitutional effort that I have made, not only me, but I have made in the Knesset, bore fruit, not full fruit, but fruit in the basic human rights laws of 1992. What we call the constitutional revolution, giving the Supreme Court the right of judicial review, which I think was very important. But still, you never end this battle. It needs to be fought constantly. And if nobody does it, and if people want to follow the masses and call themselves leaders, when in fact they are led by the masses, by the pollsters, then it's bad. People need to say what they think is right, even if the majority would not like it. Now, this is leadership. It's not to say what everybody believes is right, not to go to the poster and ask him what the people want to hear, and this is what I'm going to say. It's what you think is right on those basic moral value issues. And this is something that needs to come from leadership. And I as I say, I praise Rubi Rivlin, our president. I want to see more people in the Likud and in other parties, by the way, Labor and others, to stand out and say these things are not legitimate at all. It's not part of political debate. This is out of the question. I think it's a question of leadership more than anything else.
Thank you so much, Dan. Are there any questions? We've just about reached our limit, but I think we can fit one more question in.
Hi, it's Merle Wolofsky calling from Boston. I've been listening carefully, and I don't know if it's a question, it's just a fear. For 2,000 years, wherever we were able to stay as one people, and we knew we were one people. And now, with the Jewish state, I really see a split coming between the diasporas, particularly in America, and the Israeli society. And I hope I'm wrong. I hope we can find the way to stay as one people.
Well, I...
Sorry.
First of all, I understand this sentiment, and I think we need to address it. First of all, the split that may develop, I see splitting or developing within the American Jewish community as well. I see people, I don't want to mention names or organizations, but I see it in not so much in the city of Boston where you live, but in many other cities. I see people who say one thing and the other who say the entire opposite. So it's a development in Jewish life, and we need to address it. I would say that the more we stay connected and talk to each other, not only politically, even educationally and other and culturally, the more we'll stay one people. It's not a definition, a genetic definition. I mean, of course, there is something in it, but if people, say, young people, Jewish people in Boston or in New York or in Los Angeles, when they learn something Jewish, they read, among other things, the same books that Israeli young Jews read here. Whether it's Israeli literature by Amos Oz or Meir Shalev or David Grossman or whoever, or older scriptures or older writers and poets, if we read something of the same, if we can make the same jokes and enjoy the same humoristic, would it be Seinfeld or the movies of Woody Allen? I don't know. You have culture developing on both sides. So if we develop it differently and separately, we'll end up separate. But if we allow for more interconnection, for more sharing of what we learn, so that my kids and my now grandkids will smile and laugh with the same jokes that your children or grandchildren do, then we keep in common. It's not a given. We need to work at it.
Thank you so much. I think we've just about reached our limit. Unless anyone has a very quick question, I think we'll wrap it up right now. Are there any more questions? Okay, so Dan, thank you so much. This was really, really an informative, one of the most informative talks, I think, that I've been on. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you all. And now evening descends on Jerusalem, and I don't see anymore the house of Ruby even on the opposite street because it's dark outside. So there's a good time to end our conversation now.
Excellent. So we'll be having another conversations with Israel and Palestine on June 10th with Sam Bahor. More information can be found on our website, which is www.progressiveisrael.org. Also, the recording of this conversation and all of our past ones are online as well. So thanks so much for joining us, and we will speak again on June 10th.
Shalom, shalom. Bye-bye.